In her 20s, Eva Hogberg Fisher looked everywhere for connection. Drugs, alcohol, therapists, boyfriends, girlfriends. Relationships weren't nourishing. They were an exchange of sex and power. Then at age 30, an undiscovered mass in her brain ruptured, and she became something she always detested, vulnerable. How to Be Loved, a memoir of life-saving friendship, is Eva's wrenching and defiant memoir about the love, friendship, and emotional intimacy she was compelled to ask for, and finally accept, when she entered the world of serious illness.
Eva Hogberg Fisher's writing has appeared in the New York Times, T, the New York Times Style Magazine, Wallpaper, Wired, and Dwell, among other places.
Welcome, Eva. It's a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Give us a little bit more on your meteoric rise and fall and what your life looked like at those points in time that then led to this book before we get into the heart of, mm-hmm. of what's at root in this book.
Yeah. So I was one of these just extraordinarily successful people. I went to really good schools. I had parents who really prioritized education. I got really good grades. I got into a really good college. I actually got fairly mediocre grades in that college, but I still believed that I was very successful. And I moved to New York City in 2003 to write about architecture, and it was a perfect time to get into magazines, which seems impossible now, but it felt like a glorious time. I was writing every single day. I was publishing at least every week. I was in the New York Times. I was in Wallpaper, which is this international design magazine. I was being flown all over the country, all over the world. I remember going to Bali and South Korea and Israel twice, and just living this sort of extraordinarily charmed life. And people knew me within the design and architecture writing world, and I was just this, like, brilliant young thing. And that was the meteoric ascent. So I remember pitching stories to the New York Times and having them accepted, and it just felt like every single door was opening for me. And I was young when I graduated, so I was still, you know, really one of the youngest writers that was, I mean, I remember being sent on assignment and I was too young to rent a car, you know, but I was writing cover stories for magazines and loved it, and also was terrified every single second that somebody would figure out that I didn't actually belong here. And so the way that I compensated for that fear was by being ever more egomaniacal and rude to other people and competitive and backstabby and sort of really, you know, let my pettier, more malicious sides out. And I was also drinking a lot to try and sort of numb those feelings of insecurity that I had. And the crash for me happened because I wrote a story for a major newspaper, and I made an error in the story, and I just couldn't forgive myself for having made that error. And I believed that I was soon to be unemployable. This is right around the time that I really hit bottom with my alcoholism. And this was also 2007, 2008, so the economy crashed. And I went from being, you know, so overwhelmed with assignments and travel and glamorous parties to trying desperately not to drink, sleeping on an air mattress in my friend Layla's apartment, you know, deciding whether I was going to buy eggs or a box of granola bars with the $5 that I had to my name. And I just left New York City. I mean, I moved to Portland. I moved in with a friend. I paid $400 a month in rent. I was a couple months behind, and I had nothing to do. I mean, I had no career. Everything basically stopped. And I remember just living in Portland and thinking, I don't have a reason to get out of bed today. Like, I don't have, there's nobody wants anything from me. And that was a low point. And from that point, I went to grad school, which I thought was a great place to hide. And my second year in grad school, everything got a little exciting.
And you want to talk about that?
Go. Yeah.
to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
I say, to say the least, it sounds.
So there I was. Actually, it was my third year of grad school. So I'd finished all my coursework, and I thought that was, you know, the most stressful thing that I'd ever have to do was go to class and write papers. And I was in a relationship that was pretty challenging for me and for my partner. And I started noticing sort of some odd personality changes. So I would wake up in the middle of the night sometimes, and I'd feel this like surge of rage, or I'd feel this surge of terror. I'd be chopping kale in my kitchen, and I would look down and my arms would feel like they were almost on fire with energy. And I would actually like throw the kale across the kitchen in this sort of fit. And I just thought, like, okay, this is a weird manifestation of stress. I mean, this is, you know, I'm just having some sort of extreme reaction to my relationship difficulties or to the pressures of grad school. And a couple weeks after this sort of kale throwing, I was standing in my hallway. I was talking to my then partner, and I suddenly felt this sort of rising blackness in my eyes. And the whole world went dark, and I came to, and she was yelling my name, and I was lying on the floor. And she said that I had just passed out. So I got checked out. They said I was fine. You know, I had a heart condition I should maybe look into, but, you know, otherwise I was pretty okay. And then the next day I was on my way to teach, and I was really, I kept feeling like I was going to throw up. And I thought, this was really unusual. So got a prescription for some anti-nausea medication and went to the pharmacy, and I couldn't figure out the order of filling a prescription. I remember thinking, I have a prescription. Where do I take it? Do I take it to pick up or drop off? Do I pick up my prescription first, or do I drop it off first? Like, I suddenly couldn't understand linear time. And I was also extraordinarily tired, and I kept sitting down on the floor of the Walgreens to rest because the effort of trying to figure out linear time was just too much. And my then partner said, you know, I think you should go to the emergency room. And I'd never been to the emergency room in my life. I mean, I'd broken a bone once, but I had not been aware that I'd broken it. And, you know, I just had no relationship to hospitals or illness or anything. So I went to the ER dutifully, again, could barely figure out what was going on. And after a couple days, they did a brain MRI, and they said, you know, to our great surprise, you have a mass in the center of your brain behind your pituitary that has ruptured. And so there's a lot of blood, and there's a lot of protein, and there's a lot of sort of ambiguous fluid that's floating around behind your pituitary. And that explained the nausea and also these sort of surges of rage and fear that I'd had, because I'd actually had this cyst pressing on my pituitary and impacting, you know, all the things that the pituitary is in charge of, which is actually a lot. It's sort of the master gland of the body. So I thought, okay, well, I can just heal from this. This is fine. I just have to, you know, go home, and I'll probably be fine in 2 days. I mean, again, I just had no conception of serious illness. And I was really worried about my qualifying exams. I was supposed to take them in a couple months, and I could barely read at this time. And so I was discharged, and then they said, well, you know, we just want to make sure that you don't have this elevated tumor marker, because sometimes these cysts are actually malignant brain tumors. And so they tested my tumor marker, and once again, to their surprise, it was elevated. And, you know, years later, I saw on a doctor's screen the code said abnormal/panic, meaning it was abnormal enough for doctors to really, you know, jump into action. Mm-hmm. So I saw a brain surgeon, which is somebody I never thought I'd meet a brain surgeon in a professional context. And he said, you know, listen, like, you have a dark spot behind your pituitary, which means that there's something there, and you have this elevated tumor marker, and together that's pretty slam dunk for an intracranial germinoma, which is a, you know, fairly rare type of brain cancer. So in the space of a very short amount of time, I went from, you know, my biggest problems being my confusing relationship, my grad school progress, you know, wanting to come back to New York and be a star again, to, you know, I'm 30 and I think I have brain cancer. And the surgeon said, we have to biopsy. You know, we need to know. And I went through this process of just, I mean, the most extraordinary magical thinking and bargaining and denial and I had no, you know, I'd seen people get sick, but I couldn't imagine what it was actually like to be in this really liminal space. And that's where I lived for the next basically 4 years.
Yeah, that's, I can't imagine. That's, I understand why you have a book out of something like that. and many lessons learned along the way in coming through this. The name, How to Be Loved, the title of your book, How to Be Loved, A Memoir of Life-Saving Friendship. How did you decide on that title?
So I thought, okay, what is the one thing that I really, really learned? And the phrase, How to Be Loved, just came into my head. I was living in a tent in Arizona, which is where my journey had taken me. And I thought, okay, I'll just write this book proposal because I have, you know, nothing else to do besides sit in this tent and wonder why I'm living in a tent in Arizona. And I just thought, okay, I'll use the phrase How to Be Loved as a placeholder and as a sort of lighthouse for keeping myself on track with this being a memoir about intimacy and love and friendship and not about the extraordinary number of medical tests that I experienced. And there's actually a section in the book where I say, you know, if this were a book about illness, here's where I would tell you all the tests that I had and the numbers that I got. But this is a book about love. And I just wanted to explore that in a sort of general way. And I also really wanted people to get to know my friend Allison, who I lived with for the couple weeks before brain surgery and who herself was dying of cancer, and she really changed my life, and she also changed the lives of the people that I know now, because she was so kind to me and she was so loving, and she showed me just a different way to support somebody and be with somebody. And she never told me it was going to be okay, and she never said, you know, you're strong and brave, and she just said, this is really scary and we don't know what's going to happen. And you know, you are a deeply flawed person and I still love you. And nobody had ever said to me, you know, at the same time, like, yeah, you're kind of a handful and you're not for everyone and you're a lot. And you know, I love you very easily and without reservation. And so I just really wanted to explore in kind of really searing and intimate detail what that kind of a relationship was like for me, and then use that as a lens to explore, like, why was that friendship so unusual? You know, why are the things that I experienced so unusual? And I think that when I talk about them, they're actually not that unusual. So what I try to say is, like, the plot points of my life might be unusual or they might seem extraordinary, but my responses to everything was really not that extraordinary. I mean, I was afraid of intimacy, and then I was shown intimacy, and I was afraid of being judged, but I wasn't. I was just loved. And so those fears feel really deeply human. And the medical stuff is it's a great propulsive plot. You know, I hope that the reader wants to know what happens next. But that was really that's the engine. And then everything that's attached to that are these much larger issues around, you know, shame and intimacy and love and expectation and grief and fear and joy, all of that.
Yeah. Can you talk about how your relationship with addiction changed when you got sick? I mean, you talk about, you know, numbing yourself with drugs and sugar, sex, mm-hmm. men, women, television, and then this came along, and how did it change your relationship with addiction?
So I broke up with my then partner the day that I found out I had to get this brain biopsy. And immediately I was like, I need to have a one night stand. Like, I just knew that that was the solution. And I kind of put it out there to my networks and said, you know, this might seem weird, but I really have nothing to lose. I mean, because I think I might die on that operating table, you know, or mm-hmm. I might be forever changed, right? I mean, they're going into my brain. Who knows what's going to happen? I might not come out of this the same Eva. But I really just want to get laid. And in retrospect, or, you know, and I write about this, like, the choice seems so sort of incomprehensible to me because I was living with Allison. I'm having this beautiful, intimate relationship with her. You know, she understands me so well. And I leave her house and I go meet this stranger who I've been set up with by a mutual friend to have an assignation that I know is not inherently emotionally meaningful, but I was so desperate to feel something besides terror. And I thought, okay, sex is going to work, right? I sort of went down the list. What's available to me? Mm-hmm. Television, sex, and food. Mm-hmm. I can't really eat anything because I was on a lot of medication and I just didn't feel, I mean, my body was just so kind of destroyed. So I couldn't really, you know, use food. I was using television for the, you know, 14 hours a day. But that wasn't enough. And so I can see now, I mean, I just switched addictions. You know, I just was like, well, okay, we're going to try this out. And, you know, the person that I had that encounter with, he was the perfect person for it. It was great. I don't regret it. and I also know that it wasn't truly deeply nourishing in the way that being, you know, platonically side by side in bed with Allison and just rubbing her back, you know, that was truly fulfilling. And also, I mean, I had to be, you know, I'd been sober for a while and I'd heard a lot of stories about pain medicine and I was really, really, really afraid to take pain medicine. And I remember the day after brain surgery, I mean, you know, they load you up in the hospital and I was on tons of steroids. So I woke up and I was like, yeah, I feel great. Like no pain, no symptoms. Like, this is great. I think this did the trick. And the nurse said, okay, well, I'm going to give you a prescription for hydrocodone. And I said, well, I really, you know, I'm not going to use that. I'll take Advil. Thank you. And I got home and as soon as the steroids wore off, I mean, I remember thinking I was in so much pain. I thought, if somebody came to me right now and said, I have a needle full of heroin, I don't know how much heroin is in there, you might die, but it might make your pain better, I would have been like, put it in my eyeball, you know, like get that into my brain. And I was so humbled by that because before then I'd been very sanctimonious about people, you know, sober people taking pain medicine. I'd been, you know, had a lot of opinions about it, and it was so humbling, and I had to learn to navigate staying sober and taking pain medicine and feel, you know, until that point, I'd always prided myself on the sort of chemical purity. You know, I'd be like, for 5 years, no mind-altering substance has passed my lips, and here I had to say, well, you know, that's not true. I've taken basically medical-grade heroin in sobriety, and can I, you know, set up enough support around myself that I don't fall back into my old habits? And I was grateful that I'd been sober for a while, and so I had a lot of really, really loving help, and particularly there's a woman that I still work with who sort of guides me through staying sober, and she had the best metaphor. She said, you know, most addicts, they put the tiger in the cage, and the only thing that they have to do is make sure that they don't open the cage, right? We put the tiger in the cage. But you have to decide when to take the tiger out for a walk, and you have to walk around with that tiger. And I think that that's much more similar to people who have food addiction, right, is you can't not eat. So abstinence isn't an option. So can I find a sort of center for myself where I know, okay, I don't have to suffer. I don't have to be in pain to punish myself for my past misdeeds, which I would sometimes think. I would think, well, this pain, you know, I deserve this pain, or I shouldn't take medicine for this pain because, you know, I used to abuse very different kinds of drugs. And I had to be taught, you know, by hearing other people with a lot of wisdom, that I didn't get sober to suffer and that my sort of martyrdom actually doesn't help anybody. And I was also really humbled because I still experience, very occasionally, but I'll experience really, really severe headaches. And I saw a neurologist and he hypothesized that I had gone too long in the beginning before taking pain medicine. And so my pain pathways had been sort of permanently altered. And so ironically, my attempt at sort of perfection and abstinence and control have meant that I now still very occasionally have to take strong painkillers for, you know, this head pain, which feels to me like I'm getting brain surgery again. So it's really, I mean, it's changed my relationship with sobriety and addiction, and that I know that there's no like, okay, now I'm safe. Like, now I'm good. You know, it's been X amount of time. I'm constantly reminded, like, I need help with this. I need to talk to people. I need to be honest. I need to be honest with myself. And, you know, I read the book now and I think about how clear it is that I was using sex so frequently. And I think I didn't see it as clearly when I was living it. I mean, I really, because I sort of bought my own hype with it. Like, I was like, no, this will work. This is, you know, I'm not using sex as a drug because it works. But then when I wrote the book and read it, you know, a year after I'd finished it, I was like, oh, I can see so clearly that I was really trying to make this thing work, that actually wasn't going to work in the same way that alcohol never actually worked and cocaine never actually worked. I just thought it might this time. You know, I thought this time it's really going to give me that relief.
So what would you say to your younger self, who is somebody who's dealing with a hyper-competitive academic atmosphere?
I think trust other people's expansiveness and kindness. And that's one of the things that I talk about in the beginning of the book. It's like, you know, the fact that I didn't really have these kinds of intimate friendships until I got into serious trouble is a reflection on me, not on my friends. My friends were there. They were awesome the whole time. They were totally available to be intimate with me. They loved me a lot. I just couldn't see it. And I think that I see a lot of, you know, I'm thinking of former students of mine who they all have the same anxieties. Like, they all come to my office hours separately and they say, I'm the only one who doesn't really get it, or I'm the only one who doesn't understand what's going on, or I'm the only one with a complicated family thing. And, you know, I would never break their confidence, but I wanted to get them all in a room and say, okay, all of you talk to each other because you're actually not alone.
Yeah. Makes me wonder how much social media has contributed to that isolation. You know, we have about 10 minutes left. I'm thinking, how did what happened to you change how now you provide support to other people when they're having a hard time?
I think it's really about showing up and not making a situation about me. I guess follow the lead of the person, but also really be present.
And you also end the book on an affirmation of uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
And do you want to talk about that and where that was born from?
I don't know what's going to happen. I really don't. I don't know that I'm not going to get sick again. I have a lot of fear of getting sick again. But when I have attachment to never getting sick again or definitely getting sick again, then I'm just like, I'm not present for anything. I try to not judge things as being good or bad. They just are. I try to have a position of neutrality and excitement and curiosity. And I truly don't know what's going to happen at all. I have no idea. And when I just embrace that and I let, you know, any discomfort or any fear sort of move through me, then I can be present for the day in which I am. And so in a weird way, there's a safety for me in just being clear that I never, sort of with addiction and sobriety, there's no finish line. There's no point at which I'm going to look back and be like, well, that was really confusing, but, you know, it's smooth sailing from here on out. I mean, I just have no idea. And that can be a tool for excitement.
You've been listening to Eva Hogberg-Fisher. She is author of How to Be Loved, a memoir of life-saving friendship. Thank you so much, Eva, for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.